All right, there we go. Perfect. Good morning, everyone. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
You can hear me good. Perfect. All right. Now, source material, Jason, were you able to share that in the chat?
Did everyone receive it? I emailed it to almost everybody, I believe. I can share it again via email.
Okay, if anybody did not get it, just maybe add it into the chat room here. And then we can make sure that you get it. Okay, there we go. Perfect. Okay, good to see you all this morning on this fine Monday morning. Baruch Hashem, the storm that they predicted to be extraordinary is still not extraordinary. We hope it remains that way. Hope everybody stays dry and safe. I know that some of my kids are happy because preemptively they canceled some school. So they're certainly celebrating. I think maybe they let off on some of their Mashiv HaRuach HaMoed HaGeshem davening, or maybe they're intensifying it. Don't know. Some of them were, some of them weren't. But meanwhile, suffice to say, everyone's safe and dry and healthy and happy, and that's most important. That's what we care about most. All right, so we got the sources before us today. As promised 2 weeks ago and last week, we're going to address the topic that I know Dr. Seinfeld mentioned a few weeks ago, just anticipating that we're going to get to this part. And this is going to be where we're going to, I won't say bring this topic to a semi-close, but certainly this culminates it mostly after we get through today's class. And we'll continue with this Sugya's topics shir with the next topic, either next week or the week after, depending on how much we get. But I certainly get done today, but I certainly welcome everybody's participation. What we're going to do, as we've done previously, is we go through a number of the sources, share a couple of the preliminary ideas specific to what our topic and focus is this morning, and then we're going to leave some time for some questions, either intermittently and then certainly at the end as well. Okay, so let's begin. So actually today, as you've noticed, that what we've done is that we've shared source material in addition to the previously cited source material. So today we're going to begin with source number 16. For those of you who have not been in the class previously or would like to review some of the previous sources, I like to just not just add today's sources and review just today's sources, but also have it part of the packet that's ultimately able to be printed for your own use. That's the totality of this topic. All right, so let's begin with what we're focusing on today, and that is endangering yourself, your own life, to save others. That's the topic that kind of brings this all together. What's your responsibility? What's my responsibility? What's others' responsibility? How much risk does a person have to take? So far what we've seen that a person must make efforts and sacrifices to save a fellow life, right? We've noticed that the Samar al Dam Riecho, which is the theme here, the topic, even though we know that there are two biblical sources, we understand to what extent a person has an obligation to make some effort. You make a phone call if you're practiced in medicine, if you're able to provide life-saving efforts to others, Lo Samar al Dam Riecho requires you to do so. We've also seen that money must be spent towards this purpose. You have to swipe your card. Now, as far as reimbursement, we've spoken about that previously. What, however, is the halacha where saving a life involves placing oneself in danger? That is something that is critical, because when we understand what that rule is, then we'll understand what and how far a person has to go. Does one have to go so far as endangering oneself in order to save somebody else's life? Now, I'm going to use just one case, and of course, there's so many. There's so many cases, but there's one case that just came to mind because I happen to have remembered that there were a number of students and volunteers who came across this situation, who were invited to the situation, some protests against the situation. I don't know if some of you remember, excuse me, in 1999, there was a team of students that were traveling to Turkey to provide assistance immediately after there was an earthquake that took place in Izmit, Turkey. There was a terrible earthquake that registered, I want to say it was either 7.5 or 7.6 on the Richter scales. It was terrible. And there were a number of students, a number of volunteers who openly refused to go. They didn't want to go because of the danger involved. Besides the fact that there were fires and disease, the fear of collapsing building, there were also serious danger of aftershocks. You know, the smaller earthquakes that often unexpectedly follow major earthquakes. So there was one particularly vocal volunteer, a leader, who began convincing others not to join the efforts. He mentioned that there were a number of foreign helpers. He noticed that of the foreign aid that came across from physical volunteer people, they had already met their own death since the beginning of the earthquake rescue mission. So he felt that not only are they not morally obligated to do so, but they are morally prohibited from going so. Now, this wasn't a Jewish group or Jewish person. So the question, of course, then becomes, like, what is this Jewish idea? What is this principle? Who is obligated to go? Can a person put? Should a person put? Is there a difference between suffik and vada, which we're going to see that is? How should such a person respond? If somebody said this to you and was convincing you not to go on a rescue mission, and of course, this is just one example, so many others, of course, then how would you respond? So the question of risking one's life to save another's is the subject, of course, of an incident recorded in the Yerushalmi. That's going to be what we're going to start with today in source number 16. And subsequently, that's cited by a number of post-scam rabbinic authorities, so on and so forth. So let's begin with source number 16. So the Gemara says, it's a Yerushalmi in Meseches Trumos, folio 47a, where the Gemara says like this, Rabbi Ami, I don't know why it says Imi, Rabbi Ami, it tsar besifsifo. Besifsifo is a town. So he was, what's it tsad? It tsad from tsad, he was kidnapped. So it tsad besifsifo, he was kidnapped and held up in a place called Sifsifo. Now the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yonasan. Rabbi Yonasan said, so he said, Yikarech hames bestinai. So it says, wrap up the dead, the mace, in what's a stinos, sodin is a sheet. And what's understood from that there's no hope from, there's no possibility of saving him, that he's perished, he's done. There's no way that he can be saved, and therefore, hames, he's dead. Wrap him up, yikorech hames bestino. Wrap him up in a sheet, he's dead. There's no way, there's no hope of saving him. So Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, one second. If that's your ruling, that's the conclusion. He says, no. Ad de ona kotel, ona miskitel ona ve'ezel, mishezivle bechela. He says, what does he say? It's either it's going to be I'm going to kill them, or they're going to kill, meaning I'm going to either kill or I'm going to be killed. I'm going, and they're going to, and therefore my going, I'm going to make sure that they're going to be released. On a ezel, I'm going to, what's shezivle bechela? Shezivle bechela means I'm going to force them. I'm going to go there. I'm going to release him by force. Rabbi Ami is not going to be a captive any longer. His life is no longer going to be in danger. And it's very simple. I will either kill or I'm going to be killed. I'm going to make sure that they will be releasing him, and I will release him by force. And so it was. That Azul of Faison, he goes up and he's Mephais them. Mephaisin means he appeases them. And Vavunele, and they gave him over. Rabbi Ami was given over. I guess he negotiated with the captors. He did what he needed to do. And he was Mephaisin, and he was able to appease them. Now, this is a very interesting case in the Gemara. Now, he says, I'm going to either kill them or I'm going to be killed. My intention is I'm going to have him be released by force. I don't know why, and now, obviously there's so many different examples, but Entebbe, the raid of Entebbe is coming to my mind. I mean, the risks that were involved, and that unfortunately, Yoni Netanyahu of blessed memory, his life was lost, and there were people that were wounded, and the danger, and the grave danger of others. I mean, to what extent does a person decide that that's going to be sufficient, that the risks are worth taking? So this story, what it does, it implies that Rabbi Shimon ben, the son of Lakish, felt that it was permissible, that it was, and again, we have to be very careful with the language, it's permissible or it's obligatory. So he felt, the implication of this Yerushalmi, is that he felt that it was permissible to risk his life. I'll kill or I'll be killed in order to save Rabbi Ami. Now, Rabbi Yonasan did not stop Rabbi Shimon from the fact he doesn't stop him. So again, this is a very important diuk in the Gemara. So number one is Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish says that it's permissible to do it, and I'm going to go to do it. And I'm going to make sure it happens. And we see that the conclusion of the Gemara is a favorable conclusion. Now, what would have been if he wouldn't have survived that? Then, of course, the question obviously is would the answer be the same? Obviously, we're going to assume the answer is yes. It seems to be irrespective of the outcome. That even if it would have been that Rabbi Ami would have died, then it would have still seemed to have been, or if Rav Shimon ben Lakish would have died, it seems to be that it would have been a worthwhile endeavor nonetheless. Now, what's the status of Rav Yonasan? Rav Yonasan, he does not stop Rav Shimon and seems to condone his action. So even though his initial statement is wrap the dead up in the sheet, and therefore there's no hope he's lost. So nonetheless, it implies that he did not obligate him to do it, but he doesn't stop him. So you have this like nuance here. He's not obligated. He's not stopped. He still goes into it. It's a happy ending, a good story that has a happy ending. But what would have been if the story wouldn't have ended that way? Would it still have been, the din would have been permissible? And the answer is, of course, it would have been, because it seems to be almost irrespective of, clearly irrespective of the outcome. Now, the following source, however, we're going to learn in source number 17, derives that one is actually obligated. Now, this is a very important point here, because here it seems that he's not obligated. He didn't have to do it. Rabbi Yonason doesn't say you have to do it. He just doesn't stop him. In fact, he seems to say that you don't have an obligation. You shouldn't do it. He's done. Wrap him up. He's dead. But this, in the case of Mishnah and the laws and the dinim hilchos ritzeach shmiras nefesh, in source number 17, the case of Mishnah's commentary in the Rambam, he explains that there's certain danger versus possible danger. And he quotes the Agos Maimonides and he says the following. Look at source number 17. He says, Kosev b'Agos Maimonides, he explains that Agos Maimonides writes that b'Yerushalmi, that in the case of the Yerushalmi, they conclude that one is even obligated to enter into a possibly dangerous situation in order to save the other. That's what the Gois Maimonides writes. It's quoted here by the Kesef Mishnah, and what we understand is the conclusion of the Gemara in source Yerushalmi in source number 16. It says, "Yerushalmi masik afilu lahachnis asim b'safik zekana chayiv." It seems though that he is obligated to put himself in the suffix, into possible danger in order to save another person. And he says, Ad Kan Lashon, it seems that this is the explanation of this of the Gemara, Venira. And it seems that the reason for this, what's the reason? Venira Shahatam, the reason for this is that Mipnei Shahalo Vadai Vahu Safek, because there's a difference between the victim and the rescuer. So he quote the Kesef of Mishnah is explaining, based on the conclusion, here is the Hagois Maimonides on his understanding of the case in the Yerushalmi, what he's basically explaining, that there's a difference between the saver, the person who's the rescuer, and the person who's the victim. Why? Because halah, meaning that he will certainly die, the person who's the victim, he's certainly going to die, the person who's held in captivity, whereas the rescuer is only in a situation of possible. When there's vadai versus possible, all the while that there's possible danger, you have an obligation to go. And that obligation is not mashma from the Gemara. It seems as if it is allowed from the Gemara. What's mashma from the Gemara is that since he does not tell him not to go, he doesn't obligate him to go, but if he goes, he goes. But that's not what this source number 17 from the Kesef of Mishnah, what we understand. He says, no, it seems here that from the Hagois Maimonides, afilu lahachnis atzmo besafek sekana chayiv. That's a very big difference. And that would call the question why Rabbi Yonason says that you should just wrap him up as if he's dead. Give up on him. It's over. Really, you would have had an obligation to do it. Why? Because the difference between his death, that's vadai, that's for sure, and yours, which is suffix, maybe it'll be the two people will survive. And the fact of the matter is that since it was that he was in a case of suffix, and anybody who's in a case of suffix, the obligation is that that person has an obligation to enter into that. Okay? And that's point number one. Now we're going to see that there's an Aruch HaShulchan in source number 18, that this idea was not preserved in normative halacha. So before we get that, any questions on these two sources? Again, it's the Yerushalmi, it's the interpretation of the Yerushalmi from the Hagois Maimonides, it's the Kesef Mishnah's quoting it, and of course that's the din in the Rambam. Any questions on this so far? Pretty straightforward, pretty clear. But that would be very interesting if you think about the entry into Suffolk Sakana. Now obviously we're going to have to use, that's where we're going to see this Aruch HaShulchan. What's considered Suffolk? How do we recognize the statistics? How do we recognize the enemy that we're dealing with if you're trying to save somebody from a marauding group of people? How do you know if you're going to enter into saving somebody in the case of the earthquake situation? And how do you know that are you putting yourself into a vada situation? What's called a vada? You know for sure. Is it for sure that that person who's held as a victim is for sure going to die? Maybe that's not even a vada. But we're going to assume from the case, in the case of Mishnah, that we'll assume in his interpretation of the Yerushalmi that that's the vada, and your entry is a suffix. Suffix, language which is very strong, is chayiv. That language obligates you to do so. Okay? No questions, comments, concerns? Yes, Doc. You've done mute yourself, sorry. There you go.
So this reminds me of the portion in the Megillat Esther where Esther had to go confront Ahasuerus, and Mordechai said to her, "You have to go." And she said, "Achata tolamit." There's only one rule for somebody who approaches the king without being called in, and that's to die. And Mordechai told her, "Al tadami b'nafshech, don't worry about yourself, because your death would be a safek, but the death of the Jewish people was a vaday."
Right. So I'm wondering aloud, it's a good question. I'm wondering if there is a difference, there must be a difference between existential threat to the Jewish people, which that's what the Purim story was. And there are obviously circumstances where you have the three cardinal circumstances where, that's going to be obviously part of what we're going to discuss. If either you're going to kill this other person or you yourself are going to be killed. So you have to allow yourself to be killed. Now, why is that? Because your dam is redder than somebody else's dam. The answer, it's not. So we see that there's a situation just incidentally that there are exceptions to that rule. And maybe we would say that the case of Megillah, the case of Esther, and why Mordechai doesn't say that your life, maybe because it's existential to the Jewish people, that would allow the differences to take place. I don't know, but it's interesting we have to package that. Yes, Joseph.
Mordechai himself says, "Revach v'hatzola yamod lehem in makom acher." So he's not giving her an absolute.
Right. So maybe that's also right. He's putting in her. Yeah. How do we reconcile those two points? I mean, it seems to be that he's reconciling it by saying that hold on to a little bit of hope. There is a chance, and even though that's the normative way that nobody goes in to meet with Ahasuerus, they have, we all know what their ending is. So therefore, who are you to assume it'll be any different? Either it's because it's existential, maybe it's because maybe there's a chance it won't be that way. Like, is a person supposed to believe that there's always going to be a possibility, even if it looks bederech hateva, like he didn't have a knowledge of it's going to be, it's going to come from somewhere else? Is that part of our amunah bitachon in the Almighty, that if we believe that b'terech hateva doesn't look a certain way, but still there's got to be Yeshua Hashem clarifying? I don't know. Good point. All right, so let's see. So the Aruch HaShulchan points out in source 18 that this idea, it was not preserved in normative halacha. And it's interesting because I find that a little bit of this source is somewhat cryptic and requires a little bit more drisha v'chakir, a little bit more delving deeper. So he explains this on in his comment in Choshen Mishpat. So he explains that there's a Bavli, there's the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. The Bavli argues against the Yerushalmi. Now, obviously, we know that we learn the Bavli. So it's interesting. He doesn't quote which Bavli he's talking about. So look at this source number 18. It says that Poskim Heviu B'Shem Yerushalmi, that the Poskim, the halachic authorities, quoted the Yerushalmi as saying, "D'chayiv adam lahachnis es atzma l'safik sekana, k'day lahatzil chaveiro," saying that one is mechuyiv, one is obligated to enter a possibly dangerous situation in order to save another person. Now, that's what he states. The Rishonim, however, the early authorities, the Rishonim, that, look at this word here. So the early ones, the Rishonim, hishmitu zeh. What's hishmitu? They left it out of, I guess, their halachic codes, mipnei shebishas shalanu, muchach, that the shas from our Talmud, and he's referring to the Bavli. Now, that's like, that infers that there's a variety of different sources in shas, that shas shalanu, that it's inferred that it is muchach she'enu chayiv lachnis esatzma. So it seems to be there's a debate between the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. The Yerushalmi, he's noich, and he agrees that chayev, the poskim say, chayev adam lahachnisus atzma l'safik sakana, that a person has to enter into doubtful possible danger, kidei lahatzil chaveiro. But the Rishonim, the earlier ones, as he was talking about, we'll talk about that in a second, they lay, hishmitu zem mipnei shabashah shalom muchach shenu chayev lahachnisus atzma. No. In the Bavli, it's not that way. It's muchach. It's proven that that's not the case. And therefore, and this is probably the most important part, umiu. And therefore, we have to get through that, which we will in just a second. However, we'll see, umiu hakol lefi ha'inyan, that every situation has to be dealt with in its own, I guess, regard. V'yesh lishkol ha'inyan, that every person has to weigh, like to put on the scale of and figure out and to determine, like there's different variables, ha'inyan. Okay, so now he's adding a little bit of a caveat here. Every situation has to be dealt with in its context. Everybody has to weigh the matter extremely carefully. You have to be very diligent and careful and conscientious about all the particulars and all the variables. But here's this interesting language. However, this matter, person should be very careful not to be overprotective of oneself more than is necessary. Now, obviously, that's a variable that's very difficult to determine. Everybody's threshold is different. Is there an arbiter? Is there an objective determining force that's able to say that you failed to engage the activity of saving somebody else because you were shameris atzma yosemidai? Maybe you're being too careful. Is there such a concept of being too careful? Maybe. Are there repercussions of being too careful? I don't know. I think that we find even today that in the circumstance of, you know, just protection that people are doing and making and providing, obviously everybody has to be careful. Shmart Modis Navsho Sechem, but the people that are derelict and rebelliously not following basic protocols. I'm not talking about those people, but does there exist a concept? And obviously we're talking about, in this case, saving other people, endangering yourself to save another person. But of course, this can apply in other areas. Like there's something called the hishtadlus, and there's an hishtadlus that you could do. My issue really personally is when a person doesn't make a hishtadlus, or if an institution doesn't make a hishtadlus. That's a different story, that of course we have to hold our institutions responsible for keeping areas and schools and synagogues and institutions safe and available for people to attend. That's a different story. But I'm talking about what I understand from the Sarach HaShulchan is maybe a person, there's such a category as a person can be lishmas atzayas midai. The chol of a kaim nefesh miyisrael, and I guess this is like the little bit of like the asterisk, if there'd be an asterisk that'd be put here, is that anyway, you should remember this, like when you're considering how stringent you're going to be with saving somebody else, with your own saving of your own life, greater than what you would extend to save somebody else's. V'chol of a kaim nefesh miyisrael kilukiyum. Remember the Gemara that we learned previously, which he cites, anybody who saves one Jew, it's as if they saved the entire world. So, I don't know, is that like a guilt trip that a person, you know, like feels that, you know, don't be overly scrupulous about your own safety and your own well-being. It's all going to work out. It's all going to be okay. And don't forget this overarching meta principle that if you save one Jew, it's as if you're saving the entire world. So we see that according to the Aruch HaShulchan, there is a machlek, is this dispute between two Talmuds, the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi, about whether to enter into suffix sakana, into possibly dangerous situation in order to save another person from a clearly vaday dangerous situation. Whereas Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish in the Yerushalmi endangered himself to save Rabbi Ami. So a number of sources in the Talmud Bavli indicate, which just quotes that Bishas, we have to go through like what those cases are and see if they're different. But nonetheless, the Aruch HaShulchan says that there are a number of sources, Bishas Shalanu, that indicate that one does not have to endanger oneself in saving another person's life. So that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. And by his, I guess, his reback to his own words, okay, everybody has to do a shikul hadas. The inyan is something that has to be determined with lots of care, conscientious consideration. And don't be overly scrupulous. Remember the meta principle, saving one Jew, saving the entire world. Now, this is an interesting just setup here. Now, indeed, and the next source, which I think is also worthy of just dissecting a little bit, the Meshech Chachma in his Perush on the Torah, Rabbi Meir Simcha of Divinsk, if anybody's ever learned the Meshech Chachma, it's actually one of my favorite commentaries. I quote it sometimes in drushas. I use it certainly for Chumash Shiurim. I love this set as far. So he proves actually from the Torah itself, the one is not mechuyev, the one is not obligated to endanger oneself to save another person. So it seems as if he rules like the Bavli. So what's the case? So if you remember that after fleeing from Paro, his own life was in danger. So Moshe Rabbeinu, he was in Midian. He was in Midian and he was waiting to fulfill Hashem's command to save the Jewish people, right? We know that he's the manik, he's going to be the person who's going to save the Jewish people. But when does he go? He's in Midian and he's like in a holding pattern before he gets deployment. So Paro had previously, as we know, attempted to kill, this is what he's saying, kill Moshe after Moshe Rabbeinu had smitten an Egyptian in Mitzri and was torturing a Jew, right? When this all happened, he runs for his life, Paro wants him dead. He goes, fine. Finds a wife, starts having children, starts his life there. We know the story. Now, when the Rebbe Hashem gives him the go-ahead to begin his mission, so now there's a transition. You're hanging out in Midian, and now you got to go and do what you got to do. You got to carry out the will of the Almighty, save the Jewish people, bring them out from bondage and slavery to Cherus, to freedom, to the promised land. So the Pasuk offers a very interesting addition. This is the Meshech Chachma, source number 19. I think it's a very beautiful source. And this is a proof from the Torah itself for the Bavli's approach, for what the, what's quoted here in the Aruch HaShulchan. Look at source number 19. So he says, the Torah says, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech Shuv Mitzrayim. Go back to Mitzrayim. And I guess the Pasuk he's assuming could have ended right there. But it doesn't. Ki mesu kol ha'anoshim ha'mevakshim es nafshecha. You know, go back to Mitzrayim. Go do my mission. Do the mission that you're called for, your tafkid. All the people that were trying to kill you have died. This is what he says. So it's a muchach from these words, from those additional words that seem to be unnecessary. Like, well, why does Moshe Rabbeinu have to know that the people that, like, was Moshe equivocating? Was he ambivalent? Was he apprehensive? Like, what? What's the reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam tells him? So this is the Meshe Chachma says. It's muchach. The mahayu chayim amevakshim es nafshula hayat sarich leilich lahotzi b'nei sami Mitzrayim. And this obviously, you know, you're talking about existential. Existential is there a difference between their impending death, like were the Jews gonna die no matter what if the slavery would have continued? In the case of Esther and the Jews in the time of Shushan Habira, they were the Geira was already the lottery was already set, the decree was already established. Is there a difference? But it's interesting when you talk about the existential threat, the Jewish people, like they were done, they were back breaking labor. That's what's happening. It's muchach, he says, the imhayu chayim ha-mevakshim, if those people who would have still been alive, still would have wanted Moshe Rabbeinu to be dead, imhayu chayim ha-mevakshim es nafsho lo hayat tzarich leilich lahotzi b'nei sami Mitzrayim. Can you imagine that? His whole job, the whole thing that's his mission, everything that puts him on the map is the Manag Yisrael, the leader of the Jewish people, who would have been obligated to go. Afo pishu kol yisrael tzrichim elav, even though everybody would have, kol yisrael needed him. Wow. And it seems that that sakana is a suffix sakana. It's fascinating, I think. So the question then becomes, so, you know, then it becomes abundantly clear. The question of placing oneself in potential danger in order to save someone else involves a dispute among a whole host of different authorities. What is the conceptual debate? What is behind these two approaches? Again, as Chazara, the Agais Maimonides explains his approach based on the Yerushalmi with the words, it seems, I don't know if you remember, we just learned, it seems that the reason for this is that the victim is in vadai danger and he's certainly going to die, whereas the rescue is only in possible danger. So we are presented with a conflict between two probable outcomes. Inactivity will result in the victim's certain death, whereas a rescue mission will only result in the rescuer's possible death. So we must opt for the rescue mission because of that. There's two probable outcomes. And that's this machlekes. That's the tension. We are presented with a conflict of the possibility of two probable outcomes. Inactivity and activity. It's kind of what Dr. Seinfeld, you're referring to last time. If I don't do anything, so I'm inactive. So is that inactivity? Am I over on the Isser of Losamar al Damri Echa if I don't do anything? I just sit passively. The answer is yes. That's what it seems. Why? Because that inactivity will facilitate, if now that you know about it, the death of the victim. So what's the rationale behind the dissenting opinion that you must opt? It means to be, it seems as if that when you, again, the Hagois Maimonides, if we would paskin like that, it would seem that you have an obligation to go on the rescue mission. You have to go put yourself in danger, suffix. Now, what's the rationale behind the dissenting position? That's the Minchas Chinuch brings us down. He says the following. So, I didn't have a chance to put this in the source sheets. I'm sorry, it's just in my own notes. So he says that with very few exceptions, this is a Minchas Chinuch, like only a Minchas Chinuch can explain. He says the following, he says that with very few rare exceptions, so mitzvos are not obligatory when they involve loss of life, even possible loss of life. Again, we're not mechliyev in mitzvos. In some exceptions, when they involve loss of life, even suffix, a loss of life. And this does include even the obligation of L'samon Adam Re'echa, not to stand aside when your fellow's blood is being shed. Now, the rule of living by mitzvos rather than dying by mitzvos appears in a Gemara in source number 20 that cites a biblical source for eating on Yom Kippur when fasting would be life-threatening. And this, of course, before we get to some more questions, is source number 20. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Yehava Hosam Hava Amina Didi. If I had been there when the Rabbanim is saying, quoted, that's the context of the Gemara, biblical sources permitting transgressing a mitzvah to save a life, I would have said, Adifa Mididu. I would have said that my source is better than theirs. Meaning, you only fulfill the mitzvah in order to, says, v'chai bohem, v'lo shiyamos bohem. We don't do mitzvahs to die by them. We do mitzvahs to live by them. And so therefore, in that situation, if there's a possibility where your life is going to be put in danger, says to say the Minchas Chinuch, based on the Aruch HaShulchan, based on these two practices, then a person's life is not, you know, in that situation, a person's not obligated to give up their life. And I guess what it all kind of maybe even boils down to, which is interesting, that there's the shikul hadas that's necessary. So therefore we understand that even though the victim faces certain death, whereas the rescuer only faces possible death, the mitzvah of lo samar adam re'echad, that you should not stand aside, do not stand aside while your fellow's blood is being shed, is not obligatory when it involves possible danger of life. So that's a very big difference. Are you chayiv, or is it okay if you do it? And if, God forbid, somebody would have died in the process, would they be held responsible, or would they be celebrated because they just simply did a mitzvah? So, and therefore, we understand this is not like a ruling, actually, by a number of leading authorities. The Radvaz has in his tshuvas, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, a variety of the Elie Rab. There's a lot of different sources that also posit that this is la halacha, that it's not mechuyev. And I guess if it's not mechuyev, is it usur? Is it prohibited? The answer is not prohibited from the Yerushalmi, understand. So we see that this is a very important transition here. Now, obviously, part of this is, how can someone favor his own life over the victim's life? Like, why is that allowed? And the Gemara also says that if a person is threatened with the tragic choice, kill him or I will kill you, so he cannot kill the other, because who says that your blood is redder than his? We are all familiar with that. Now, if someone refrains from rescuing another person, isn't he deciding that his blood is redder than the victim's? Like, isn't that the same case? So how do we understand that? So if we paskin halach like the Radvaz and the Rabbim, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and we understand like the Aruch HaShulchan that we just quoted here, and this, right, all these sources here, and Chai Behem V'lo Yomos Behem. So if we know in a situation, the tragic circumstance where a person will be put to this terrible test of kill him or I'll kill you, he has to allow himself to be killed, right? Of the three cardinal sins, three cardinal averas that a person, okay, you have to, that's the choice you have to make. But why is it any different? How is it any different? I'm throwing this out there. But how is it any different that if someone refrains from rescuing another person, isn't he likewise deciding that his blood is redder than the victim? So I'll just share with you again, the Minchas Chinuch quotes, and that Minchas Chinuch, he quotes from Tosfos, who explains that in a situation of choice between one life and another life, it's prohibited to actively kill to save his own life. He makes a difference. This is a chiluk between actively, you kill him, so you're actively killing him. Versus, however, if someone ends up killing passively, right? So I guess he doesn't show up to this rescue mission, right? So he can let himself be saved, because the difference between actively killing somebody and passively killing somebody. That's what the Minchas Chinuch answers. He quotes a Tosafot that says that's the case, and that would be the din. So if that's a din and that's a difference, actively and passively is very important to this. And then you can let yourself be saved. In our case that we've been discussing, so in a situation, if determined that a rescuer is passively refraining from saving and is not actively killing, so there's no obligation upon him to risk his own life. So that means I could choose not to do it because, all right, even if it means that if the outcome is a suffix that the person's going to die, then for sure you don't have to do it. Even if it seems from the Minchas Chinuch that even if it is that it's a vadai that person is going to die, but since it's a passive vadai that your involvement or your lack of involvement is a passive involvement, so that doesn't obligate you to do it. That means you don't have an obligation to lose your own life at the expense of somebody else losing their own life. At the same time, of course, we conclude with the Aruch HaShulchan's warning to be truthful and honest about defining danger. And I think at the end of the day, that's part of what this is going to be, which is why it's such a difficult topic, because there's so many things about it that are ambiguous. Because if we understand the Aruch HaShulchan's final statement, the warning to be truthful and to be honest about defining danger, and to not be so overly protective, Yosemidai, more than oneself, to protect oneself, so then Those are variables that are not objective. Those are variables that maybe a physician will call objective. Maybe you need to interact with somebody who's going to be able to help you make that decision. But sometimes time's of the essence, and you're not able to really go, you know, through all the sugya to figure out. Like, you know, God forbid there's a fire in a person's house. So if it's a minimal fire versus a big fire, of course, the dinim are different. So you're not going to go now, open up a Mishnah Brura and figure out, okay, there's a fire in my house. Okay, is this quasi? Is this major? Is this considered small? I mean, in the case of the postgame, if you have like a small contained fire, let's say you have a toaster oven, for example, that was, I don't know, something caught inside and on fire, and you had to take care of it because you don't want it to spread. So postgame say, so you put, and again, this has to be, I'm saying this tongue in cheek, very, you have to be careful, responsible. If this is a suffix, you have to take care of it. So it's not really the same example. But obviously, what happens in the postgame say, you put around it, you put cups, let's say cups that would be able to, well, filled with water, that are meltable, plastic cups, let's just say. And when the fire gets to the, you know, the cups, the plastic will melt, the fire will be doused by the water that's in the cup, and shalom Yisrael. You're not going to grab a Mishnah Brura and it's like, okay, what's the status of this fire? By the time you do that, the fire is going to be spread, and God forbid, people are going to, injured or worse. So obviously the difference between passively and actively, so you have to know what's considered a truthful, honest assessment. What's definition of danger? What does it mean to not be overprotective? It's interesting. These terms are terms that I think are so relevant to today's pandemic, because it's very difficult for some to figure out what's truthful reporting, what's honest reporting. What is the definition of danger? How are statistics figured out? And maybe is there some level of being too protective? Is there such a concept? I'm curious what some of the doctors here say and feel about that. Is there a concept of being too overly protective of oneself? Is there just fear of fear? Is that, you know, living in fear, is that something that could be crippling in and of itself? Of course, we know that that's what it is. So just a quick wrap up just of what we've done here for now. And then, of course, let's save some time for some questions, because that could obviously take us to the end here. So number one, this section here that we've been discussing this morning, does a person endanger his own life to save another's life is in certain danger? So according to some authorities, this question involves a machlokes between two Talmuds, the Yerushalmi, of course, we quoted, and the Bavli. The Yerushalmi records an anecdote that implies that one should enter possible danger to save another person who is now in certain danger, and a minority opinion rules in this way. That's a minority opinion. Most authorities rule based on the inferences from the Bavli, and the laws of protecting one's own life, as we learned in the case of Mishnah in various other places, Aruch HaShulchan, then one does not need to enter such a situation. And if one is not obligated, it follows that he should not risk his own life. And this seems to be normative halacha. And again, when that's the conclusion here, part of what has to be part of this spoken conclusion, obviously, is this Aruch HaShulchan's warning to be truthful and honest about defining danger, not to be overprotective, yosem yidai. And that is the gray area. That is the area that is subjective, and a person is going to make that decision and determination based on their own assessment of the situation, which could, might, or might not be accurate or enough for the situation. But that's really like the main section of these two disciplines, the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Kesef Mishnah, of course, and the final Gemara in Maseches Yuma, the Gemara of Chai Behem and V'Lashlo Yomos Behem. Okay, before we transition into another section, let's give some time to open this up to the floor. Straightforward, clear?
Rabbi?
Yes, Linda.
If you're employed as a rescue worker, you don't have a choice whether or not you go in and put your life in danger. So isn't there a difference between the employed and just the guy walking down the street, whether he goes in to help?
I would assume that there is a difference, although I'm not convinced 100%. And why? Because I'm curious what the doctrine of hire, of that employment is. If you're a firefighter, if you're an emergency medical technician, if you're a doctor for that matter, like what are the medical ethics? What are the ethics? Are there codes of ethics that someone has to subscribe to because of a chosen profession? I can't imagine, even though we would assume that there are certain people that are fit for saving people because of what they've chosen, I can't imagine that that's, I mean, legally binding, or I don't even know if that's morally binding.
Why would you hire? Why would someone be hired who would not, and they go up to a fire and say, "Oh, this one I'm not going to participate in"? I think there's a complication.
Right. So maybe their threshold for pain is higher. The threshold for daring and rescue is something that maybe some of us would never even consider. And that threshold is part of what we employ. And we hope that, you know, it's the common basics that we're going to just assume they're going to take care of. I don't know. If let's say they're looking at something that's really, really life threatening. I don't know. Dr. Seinfeld, what do you think about that? Before you have to unmute, sorry. I want to hear what you have to say.
Look, I don't think whether you're a physician, an EMT, a police officer, a firefighter, I don't think it means that you throw out common sense. Yeah, if a firefighter, I don't think can say, well, there's a fire, it's a small fire. I really don't want to go in today. I mean, that's really not an option. Yet if there's a fire where there's clearly a direct risk that this person will never come out of it, I can't see. Look at the firefighters who went into the World Trade Center when that building was struck by an airplane. I am sure many of them knew that there was a high likelihood they weren't going to come out of that. And they each had to make a very quick split second decision about what they were going to do. I don't know that there's a clean black and white situation here.
Would it have been a dereliction of their duties had they had somebody chosen either not to enter the fire into the World Trade Center, or I'm just even thinking about, you know, the disengagement in 2006 when soldiers were taking orders from the prime, you know, from government to act on their command to move people from certain settlements. Like, is it a dereliction of your responsibility if somebody chooses not to do it and not to go on that call? I mean, I'm curious. I'm sure there's so many cases where that it's been argued in courthouse.
And I'm sure the firefighters union most likely has some kind of a, you know, statement that says there may be certain circumstances in which you can say, this is too much of a risk. I'm not going to do it. And they may come up for a disciplinary hearing and may have to defend what they're doing. But these are decisions that often have to be made on the spur of the moment. You don't have time to, no pun intended, daven over it. And you just have to decide what you're going to do. And it's not an easy decision.
Right. What are your thoughts about just the proposal of, and I would even say the conclusion of gray, because it's always easier when you learn a Shulchan Aruch and a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and you learn that, you know, there's 18 minutes matzahs, there's tefillin that are supposed to be this color, you know, the Shemoneh Esrei has this amount of brachos, the obligation of Birchas Hamazon is when you eat this amount of pas, it's like very definitive. When you have cases like this where the conclusion isn't like that, so what does that open up? How does that reverberate? What's considered dangerous? What's the body that, I mean, I guess, is it, maybe it's a medical block that determines something's dangerous. Is there, when you leave people's subjectivity to the matter or any matter, how do you do that? How do you determine that? Like, what do you take from this? This sugya these are just, you know, if I was going to be, lenient or lean towards one particular side, I would have just shared with you the Aruch HaShulchan and quoting the Bavli. But of course, there's the Yerushalmi, which anybody knows. The fullness of this topic includes both of these sides. And of course, the Kesef Mishnah and the Rambam is very important to this. But normative halacha then does not obligate you to do that. That's the Radvaz, that's the Rambam. But then what happens? If you're not obligated to do it, like what happens with Hatzalah? What happens with EMS? What happens to, you know, all these types of situations? And there's a level of gray. Is there such a thing of being, can you be too cautious? Like I was always raised, you can never be too cautious. That's what my, you know, but maybe you could be too cautious. Maybe there's something that's, you can imperil yourself by being too cautious. And how does it relate to contemporary times now? Like, I think this is such a contemporary topic, like hugely contemporary. And when a person is cavalier and what that means to their behavior as it relates to somebody else. What do you think about that? Is it too non-script? Is it too ambiguous? Is it too non-conclusive? What do you think?
I'm very much swayed by the Meshech Chachma, because all of the other, you know, Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'acha is a very broad commandment, and then the Mefarshim give different explanations, you know, if someone is being killed or some, et cetera, et cetera. But the Meshech Chachma is citing something directly from the Torah, where Moshe is being told specifically, you know, in so many words, you know what, you didn't have to go before, but now you can go because you're not in any immediate danger. I think that's telling you directly, Midyaraita, that it's okay to not put yourself in imminent danger to save someone else.
Right. So I'm wondering, is it, I guess I'm vacillating myself and trying to understand, it's okay that he didn't, or was it usser had he, would he have gone, would it have been usser for him to have gone? And is it a vaday that he would have died? It's not that it's a vaday, that's a suffix that he would have died. Maybe he wouldn't have died. Again, we also remember Vayakam Melech Chadash Shalayodas Yosef, the two girsas in Rashi quoted by the Gemara, that's a Gemara in Maseches Sota. Paro wanted him dead. Like Paro wanted him dead. It was a theological battle that they ended that he didn't kill him and Aaron, but he wanted him dead. Like that was very clear. He wasn't mysterious about that. So would it have been usser for him to have gone, or is it just okay that he didn't go? I agree. The Meshech Chachma that's on is a very 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 strong source. You didn't have to go. The Yerushalmi, one thing, but you didn't have to. And this is a Kodesh Baruch Hu, adding words in Chumash where there's no added words. That is the way it's told them that you can go now. The mission can begin by simple version of the people that have Mevakshim Lenafshecha, they died. It's very strong, right? Yeah. If he would have gone and he would have died, obviously no specific case here, but if he would have gone and he would have died, would he have done something wrong? I'll take it one step further. Would it have been that he committed suicide? Was it a suicide mission? Is it usser? And if it was usser and he did it anyway and he died, how do we treat somebody who, God forbid, Rahman al-Islam committed suicide? So I don't know. That part is a little bit, you know, also a little bit challenging, because obviously it wouldn't have been that it would have been suicide, and obviously it was not, you know. He was doing the will of God, and maybe in that time, like, he just had no idea, and he didn't know. Maybe he didn't know until God told him what. That was the instruction. That's the moment of instruction, that you go into a situation, only in a situation that doesn't really seemingly imperil your own life. And obviously it was a danger just going, nothing to do with the people that wanted to kill him. But I think that source is also very strong. Yes, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, did you want to add something?
No, I'm just listening. I hear you. But there are a lot of issues. I mean, when you're getting into now, you know, when you mentioned things following orders, you know, and even when your life's not at the risk, you know, do you always have to follow orders? And the question which I was going to ask you when you mentioned this in Shul, when you say, you know, you shouldn't stand on the dumb of your brother, does that only refer to Jews or also to non-Jews? When you, for example, running into, let's say, the World Trade Center, if you knew that everybody there was not Jewish.
Good question.
Do you have an obligation?
It's a good question. We have an obligation to be Or L'Goyim. We have to be a light unto the world. The obligation for humanity. You know, we don't have to just save our own people. We have to save humanity. But it's a good question. And that's hotly, hotly debated. I think there's a big risk when there isn't one authoritative body. You know, again, I don't know this to be 100% true, but as you all know, that Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks sadly passed away on Shabbos, and Rabbi David Feinstein passed away on Erev Shabbos. And I was watching some of the funerals yesterday, and I was thinking about Rabbi David Feinstein. I'm going to share some thoughts on Shabbos about both of them and their impact and their Torahs and things of that sort, which can't really capture that all in one Shabbos in a short, relatively short speech. But I was thinking about Rabbi David Feinstein's funeral, and they kept referring to Rav Moshe, and you know, I don't know this to be completely true, and what I do know is this wasn't completely true, but when Rav Moshe was alive, as they say, that his halachic authority was contested, obviously, by many, but was more unilaterally followed than it wasn't followed. And of course, today we're missing that. We're missing that Das Torah. We're missing that body that everybody, you know, there's no dispute about what that body is. You know, we all know that whether it's religious things or whether it's medical things, everybody's become like the arbiter for their own well-being. You have people that are choosing, they'll read a document that comes from a, you know, center of disease control, and they'll say like, okay, like I'll parse through that, and that looks good, and that doesn't look good, and that might be, and that should be, and then they create their own document, and I don't know how that happens. There's a grave danger and a tremendous amount of stumbling block and huge confusion that happens when that happens. And if there was a clarity, so then it's a little bit easier. So I do think that listening to an authority, whatever that authority is, sometimes we listen to authorities, we don't always necessarily understand what it is. When there's no trusting of the authority, I keep referring to this book that I've been reading. It's Extreme Ownership, it's called. And in the section, it describes about when a leader doesn't believe in the mission, the people don't believe in the mission. And when the people don't believe in the mission, so it all trickles down from the top. So when the top isn't like so strong and the top doesn't believe in it, and if even if they are top, but no, they do believe in it, but others around them don't, there's chaos, there's danger, there's death, there's sickness, there's capture. I think you see that in a lot of different areas. Yes, Sid. You have to unmute, sorry. There you go. I still don't hear you. Maybe the volume is down. Can you try now? Maybe the volume on your computer is down. There you go. Nope.
Rabbi,
when you say we don't have an
authoritative source, you know, even within the Jewish religion, forget with all the different Jewish communities between Eretz Yisrael and Chul, you don't have one authoritative source, and you'll have psak halachas that are issued by the chief rabbinate of Israel, which are not followed chutz la'aretz. So even with our own Jewish community in Israel, outside of Israel, we don't have a central position.
It's hard. You know, to learn about locus in dispute, in Gemara, in Talmud, like you're trying to discover the truth, and that happens with a variety of disciplines and understanding what the truth is. But it's hard. Like, I agree with you. That's not an easy thing. Joseph, do you want to comment on that?
I guess two things. I'm trying to remember the famous article, Soloveitchik, about the loss of the mimetic tradition. Different people had different customs. There never was one uniform system in Yahadus. The failing is that we don't pick somebody to follow. Mm. Nowadays, as lawyers call it forum shop. You figure out the answer you want, and you look for the person who'll give the psak. As opposed to saying, no, this is the person whose authority I follow. Functionally, going back to the question we're dealing with, my father used to always deal with halacha functionally. And it's really, I'm really saying what Dr. Seinfeld said, that, you know, are we going to daven over this? These are cases. Who are the Eidei Hasra? What are they going to tell them? How are you going to adjudicate this in a case? These are things that are so that you can't, you'll never get somebody in a Jewish court facing a death sentence over this issue, because it just can't happen. This particular, as you say, it's a soft tissue kind of thing. You're just never going to figure it out. And functionally, the best then really can't deal with it. Because one of the Hasra, the Eidei Hasra, are going to say, Lo Samad al Dam Reecha, get into that building. I mean, it's not going to work that way. So it really does go back to what Dr. Seinfeld said, what you were saying. It's so subjective, but it's never going to be in a court of law. Our problem is that we don't have someone we say, this is the person I will follow. We go on the internet, find somebody who says what I want them to say, and that becomes what I do.
It's terrifying. But I guess the only satisfying conclusion here is that, you know, today we're so focused on what other people think and what other people will respond. Like, this is such, a principle that this has nothing to do with anybody else. Like your own morality, your own judgment. Like you're right. It's not able to be tried in a Beis Din. You can't, you're not going to have a straw. You're not going to have Edom. You're not going to have what you should have, could have, even though it might be that your negligence caused this person to die. Who knows? But at the end of the day, this is literally just about you and your own judgment. What's your obligation? Your obligation is to be a certain way. Now, where there's an intersect is where that, in, where that traffics into involvement with other people, like coronavirus, like what you consider. I know a lot of people think, they'll say to me, Rabbi, we're being very, very careful. But like in a second, I poke a hole in how they're not really being so careful, right? Whether you drop a mask, where you don't wear a mask, where you're not really social distance, whatever those things are, I'm careful, except for when I want to go to the movies, then I'm not so careful. Whatever those exceptions are, right? So then when there's a trafficking of an intersection between your decision and other people's decision, I don't know. I'm struggling with the fact that there isn't a body that can discipline really people's behavior when their behavior really does put other people's life in danger. And this is a very interesting difference, because a difference between somebody's life is in danger. You're working. That's the working premise here. Somebody's in a perilous situation. Do you have to go out and save them? What happens if, as a result of your negligence, you're being derelict, you're causing people to be in a dangerous situation?
But you know, maybe some source material would be the plagues in the Middle Ages. Were there any Piskei Halacha on that?
Okay, good. We'll have to look into that a little bit.
Because we have it.
Right.
Where, you know, what did, and they did have systems of enforcement. In other words, the community in a given town, there was a Beis Din, they did have the ability to reprimand people, to punish them. But I'm not aware of any.
We got to look into that. Yeah. So this isn't just a shave al taiser. The kum ase is the kum ase get up and save somebody. But the kum ase get up and save somebody might also be that you're getting up and saving something is through active restriction, actively not doing something, right? I'm going to actively not engage in this, whatever it is, right? Maybe that dereliction is because of the fact that you didn't do such a thing. You caused that person to be their life in danger. It's such a scary application, because this is really thinking from the victim is out there and you have a responsibility, or don't, to enter into suffix. Vada, you don't have to. Suffix machlekes. So now what happens if your suffix and your actions, inactions, are causing other people to be in peril? Your situation is you're good.
Yeah.
I think it's terrifying, actually.
But there's also the element of being an embarrassment when you have, like in New York, certain areas, certain zip codes, all of which were, you know, religious Jews, have to be shut down because they're not observing the rule.
Actually, I'm finding today, just in my conversations and in my involvements, community from the RCA, from our community, I'm finding that the people that are feeling most embarrassed, I mean, maybe that's not even the best word, but right, embarrassed population, is the population of people that are, quote, still doing it. There's a mother called me Saturday night. She was crying to me because there was a bar mitzvah in the community and 99% of the population, quote, is not doing it. Kids aren't doing it. The administrators from the school aren't doing it. The teachers aren't doing it. This is one of the big schools in our town. They write in their literature, you have to wear be socially distant. You have to have masks. I know this is being recorded. It's a battle that I'm engaged in. Their own teachers, their own staff, they're at this department, and they themselves aren't wearing it. This mother calls me up, she's crying to me because they have to still do it. They have a parent that has some compromise and they have to do it. And she said, she walks to the bus and like, oh, you're still doing it? Oh, you're wearing a shield and a mask? Well, that's a joke. It's outside. And so it's outside. So now here are the rules. So she's crying to me that she's embarrassed. The child's embarrassed. Shame on the institutions that haven't protected the kids and the families that have to do it. These institutions, all their leadership should be, in my opinion, should be held responsible. That to me is just, forget about the fact, like now, okay, so let's say nobody gets it or nobody gets sick, and please God, nobody gets really sick or worse. But is there some help being held responsible for the busha, for the mental anguish, this to me like a huge, huge sugya that everyone's overlooking. And there's and because I believe there's a solution, you can make your institution safe that everybody, that even are on the fringes, can participate. You don't like masks? Okay, you can handle it. You need a mask? You can handle this. I mean, whatever it is, you gotta be Switzerland in that sense. You gotta be safe for everybody. Whatever. That's a topic for another time. All right, we're at the high noon hour. Thank you so much, everybody, for being with us, for joining. Look forward to next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Rabbi, one last thing. I just got a text from Jay Falick. He just became a grandfather. His son had a little girl, Leia.